And I'd like to begin this segment of Prayer Quest with a bit of a summary of where we have been thus far in our series and put us in touch with what we do in this segment. We began with the human need for the infinite, noticing that it can be found only in God Himself. And then we went on to indicate that, briefly, that there's a kind of divine union involved in this and a transformation of the human person, but there are impediments to this growing and intimacy with God, who is the sole answer, the quenching of our thirst. And we have to reckon, therefore, with these obstacles in the way. Then we considered the dimension of wonder and its enrichment of the human person and how that fits into the picture. Then, finally, we began in our last segment the question of leisure, work, and human fulfillment. And we take up at that point in this session. We have indicated what leisure is not. It's not, for example, merely time off, not working, or as the common expression puts it, it's not goofing off. It's much richer than that, as we shall be seeing as we go along. Then, to get the idea of leisure, rather than begin with a definition and explain the definition, I'm going to take the opposite approach, and we will end up with a definition. Namely, we are going to describe the differences, you could put them in columns if you wanted to, mentally, if not in written form. And on one column, we're going to have leisure and traits of leisure, and then we're going to contrast that and are contrasting it with the traits of work. And both of these, as you notice, occupy large pieces of human life. As a matter of fact, most of human life is either working or what we're calling here leisure, at least a well-ordered human life. The first three of the differences I'll summarize rapidly. We notice that in work, we produce something. And I took the example of someone on an assembly line putting cars together, or could be putting TV sets together. The person does the same thing, and in the process is producing TV sets or automobiles. Or, if one is selling insurance, produces a policy. In leisure, on the other hand, you don't produce anything. What you do is drink reality, and in the drinking of the reality, you're enriched. I use the example of Mozart. When you listen to Mozart in a leisure manner, not as preparing for a music appreciation class, that might be work, but just to drink the beauty of that music, you're being enriched. And if you take another example of leisure, just enjoying an orchid or a rose, you're not producing a single thing, you're being enriched by it. The second difference we noted is that work is a means to an end. This is a bit philosophical, but when you work, you're dealing with something that leads you to another person, not another person. Yes, that little mistake was correct. It does lead you to a person, but it leads you, when you work, to an end which relates and perfects persons. So the person putting together a car is for serving transportation needs of human beings. But the putting on the bolts is a means to an end, whereas leisure is the end itself. It is not a means. If somebody were to say to you, I love you because of, or for the sake of, you can be sure that is not love. Love is its own end. Leisure is its own end. And you do it just for the sake of itself alone. Work is active, therefore, and moving and doing, whereas leisure is receptive and passive and being. That brings us then to our next difference between the two. In work, we are changing the world. The person putting together a car is changing not only material things, plastic and iron and steel and so on, and glass, but is changing the world in the sense of providing for human beings a mode of transportation to get from one place on the planet to another. If someone is selling insurance, a different type of work, what is being changed is the security of human beings from being insecure financially to being secure. Something is being modified in the world. Right now, at this moment, I'm teaching, which is considered philosophically a work, perhaps the most lofty work, but it's a work. And I'm not speaking just for its own sake, I'm speaking in order to communicate truth, to enrich persons. And in that sense, people are being changed. Whereas in leisure, you don't change the world, you celebrate the world. If you're looking at a starry sky at night, a leisure time activity, or that orchid, or listening to Mozart, or gazing at that leaf we spoke about last time, just to drink the beauty of Mozart, or the orchid, or the starry sky in wonder at it, you are celebrating reality. And most of all, of course, we want to understand that reality to be not only small r, but big R, God Himself, the supreme reality. As we shall be noting later, the supreme example of leisure is resting in the Trinity, being enthralled, ecstatically enthralled in the Trinity and the beatific vision. But that will come later for a more detailed treatment. The fifth difference between leisure and work is that in working, we focus on parts. This work, this bolt, this insurance policy, this particular lesson in our series, and therefore work of its nature is constricted. Now, that is not a bad word here, but it has to focus on one thing and therefore be focused in a constricted sense on a part of reality. Whereas in leisure, we are open to the whole. Leisure of its nature doesn't hold you down to one thing. So if you're thrilled with the beauty of Mozart or Beethoven or Bach, you're kind of just open to beauty in general, the general celebration of musical reality. So that in a leisure time activity, you are open to joy, delight, freedom. It's of its nature. Work constricts, necessarily not bad, but it's that kind of thing. Leisure opens to the whole, and most of all, to God Himself. The sixth difference, in case you're wondering how many there are, seven. The sixth difference is that in work, things happen. The car is produced, the insurance policy is sold, the class is taught. Whereas in leisure, you happen. You are enriched, transformed, and made more beautiful in that Ezekiel text we considered earlier in our series. In a leisure time activity, the person is enriched, and if I may coin a word, if you're listening to Beethoven, you are musified. You'll notice after a stirring liturgy, and suppose the liturgy closes with the recessional hymn, something very stirring, and you like the music, you'll notice that you tend to hum it afterwards if you're not distracted by something else. It has changed you, it has enriched you, that music, or the other example, the orchid or the rose. You're rosified in drinking the beauty of that flower, and therefore you happen in leisure. You already see how immensely important this whole matter is. If people do not have leisure, they're just truncated. And even that's a little complimentary. It's less than that. They're impoverished as human persons. And that brings us to the last difference between the two. And we will now have a pretty complete idea of this leisure. In work, one remains in the humdrum, everyday sphere of this world. I don't use these words in a pejorative, damaging, or unappreciative sense. When I say humdrum, daily activity, that's necessary. We are in space-time. We have to work. It's important. But nonetheless, work deals with this world, the car, the insurance policy, and it's very much a thing of time. And therefore, it's dated immediately almost. In leisure, you take a kind of step out into eternity. Yes, I know, we remain very much in time while we gaze at the orchid and admire it and listen to the music, but there is a kind of way in which you're brought into the eternal order. It's something like play, pure play. Play is something like leisure, but not exactly the same thing. We won't go into those differences. But where you have pure play, I don't mean playing something for a salary that could become work, But say a youngster at the beach, or it might be an oldster, I like to do it myself. You splash the water and it just shoots out, and if it's a sunny day, you see all those colors in the water. It's a thrilling thing. Now, you could just splash water at the beach as a leisure time activity, but it would be very close to playing. And you notice in that enjoyment, a youngster will probably enjoy it a great deal. If the adult is really alive, he will enjoy it too, you see. You'll notice that you step out of time in a kind of way in that enjoyment. Or to take a basketball game, another good example, when it's really a game and it's not a work. It doesn't matter that it is 2:30 Eastern or Pacific time in the basketball game. You step out of human time. What matters is it's the third quarter with 2 minutes to go. That's what matters. So that in our leisure activities, we step out of time into eternity. And that, of course, is a kind of stepping out. The final leisure, of course, will be eternity, literally. We are ready now for a definition of leisure. That is the way we have proceeded. A few examples of work, leisure, and now we see all the elements of it. We're ready to appreciate a brief statement of what it is. We can say, and here I must confess that I am depending on Joseph Pieper, who wrote a little classic on this subject, Leisure, Basis of Culture. If you get your fingers on it, it'd be really worthwhile reading. I'm depending on him, though I'm not quoting him verbatim. Leisure is an open receptivity to drink reality and be transformed, enriched by it. Now, let's take it piece by piece. Leisure is an open receptivity. It's not a bump on a log. It's not simply not working. It's an openness and a receptivity in the human person. We're finite. We need to be completed by the other. Can't be completed ourselves. If you had a baby who never had any contact with the other, you'd have a vegetable growing up. It would be just a thing almost. We have to therefore be enriched. And so leisure is an open receptivity. All these examples of leisure, you notice, are receptive. Mozart, the leaf, the starry sky, the beatific vision, we're all receiving and being completed. An open receptivity to drink reality. Reality here means the things I've been talking about, the music, the flowers, the starry sky, small r, but most of all it means capital R, God himself. Because as we said in the very first session of this series, we said that the human person is fulfilled by nothing finite, cannot be. And we gave you reasons how you experience this in your own life. Whether you're a religious type of person or irreligious, you have the same basic need as anybody else for complete infinity. That's what you yearn for. And therefore, the reality that will solve this problem, the human puzzle, has to be most of all, capital R, God himself. So leisure is an open receptivity to drink reality. Yes, created things, they fulfill us. But most of all, to drink God himself. Notice how this connects with contemplation, and be transformed, enriched by this reality. We've already talked about that in past segments, that this leisure sort of thing, we were calling it wonder and so on, quenching, being quenched at the fountain, most of all God himself. We've been putting this in different ways, and now we see, I think, a little more comprehensively what it's all about. So, finally, the definition. Leisure is an open receptivity to drink reality, mostly capital R, and be transformed and enriched by it. Now, we take up some consequences. What follows from this concept of leisure? The consequences I should like to suggest to you are basic, and they are profound. And if you and I live these consequences, we'll never be the same. As a matter of fact, I don't know how you'd get more profound or relevant, if one likes to be relevant. Most of us do. I do. I don't know how you could be more relevant than what we're talking about here. If you want the human person, yourself, to be fully beautiful as Ezekiel describes we should be. The first consequence is that, according to God's word, leisure, eternal ecstasy is the final leisure, the eternal ecstasy of the beatific vision. This leisure is our final destiny as human persons. We were created for leisure. Let me give you two examples from Scripture. Psalm 17, verse 15. For me, the reward of virtue, the reward of living a good human life, being patient and humble, industrious, honest, chaste, and all the rest of it. The reward of virtue is to see your face. For the Hebrew in the Old Testament, it meant the divine presence. And there is a suggestion here of beatific vision, though it's not real clear at this point in Revelation and the development of Revelation. So for me, the reward of virtue, the reward of doing all the things a human being is supposed to do, is to be immersed in the divine presence. That's what the face refers to here. And on waking, to gaze my full on your likeness. That sounds very much like the beatific vision. That our destiny is to gaze on Father, Son, and Spirit, be ecstatically enthralled, unspeakably enthralled forever. And that is the supreme leisure. We have it in the New Testament. In 1 Corinthians 2:9, Paul saying, "Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has it entered the mind, the heart, what things God has prepared for those who love him." That is a borrow from Isaiah. And St. Paul is saying here that you've seen nothing like it. Of course, nothing like it. Nothing can compare with God, can't even come close. You've seen nothing like it. You've heard nothing like it. Even the most beautiful music, gorgeous as it is only the palest and faintest reminder of God himself. You've seen nothing like it. You've heard nothing like it. You can't even imagine what God has in store for those who love him. Suppose, on this point of not being able to imagine, suppose you had 20 centuries to do nothing but try to imagine what you'd like to be. And the supreme joy and the supreme ecstasy, and you'd like it to be eternal, no doubt. There's no doubt about that at all. And you had 20 centuries to try and imagine what you'd like to be and do. Well, Paul is saying, pal, after 20 centuries, you're not even close to understanding what God has in store for you. Now, this will strike some people as just unspeakably optimistic that it couldn't really be that way. But Scripture is full of this kind of statement. I should like to apply our definition to this final eternal ecstasy, which is the supreme leisure, our final destiny. Notice we said about leisure just a few moments ago that it is an open receptivity. In this final gazing on Father, Son, and Spirit that will render you and me ecstatic forever, it's entirely receptive. We've got to be purified of all of our faults to be capable of the beatific vision. And so there has to be an open receptivity to drink reality. Metaphorical way of speaking, of being absorbed and receiving God just as he is. We don't know him that way on earth, of course. But there we're going to drink him as he is and be transformed, enriched, and we can add now, rendered ecstatic forever. There's no ecstasy on earth, of course, that is of any great duration at all. It all ends, sometimes with eventual jadedness and disgust, maybe. But this ecstasy never becomes jaded. That's another subject we can't go into, but it's of the nature of it that you will be just awed forever with not the least boredom for eternity. That's the first consequence, and you can't get more crucial or fundamental than that. The second consequence refers to this life. The first one, our final destiny, is the supreme leisure. Our second consequence, our work in this world exists for leisure, enrichment, and not leisure for work. I think many people, if they would consider vacation a leisure experience, it could be, not necessarily, but it could be, they would think that, many people, I suspect, would think that they take a vacation so that they can return to their work refreshed. Now, that's having things backwards. There's no doubt that resting, vacation, time off, enables us to recoup our forces and energies and work better. That is true. I'm not denying that at all. Of course, it's obvious. I'm just saying that in the nature of things, the main idea of work is to provide leisure for oneself, one's family, other people, that they can provide circumstances, that is, so that they can enjoy leisure and be enriched in this way. If I may use an example to make that point. If a plumber comes to your home because you called him to repair some pipes that are leaking, if he is properly motivated, that is, not only to earn a livelihood for himself, but he wants to do good for you, and he loves you in a proper way, as we're to love everybody, and he wants to provide your heating system with the proper piping, that it works properly, so that you in turn can carry on your daily activities, and if you are well motivated, also have time for the leisure, so that even plumber's work is aimed at leisure. And certainly what I'm doing right here, which is a type of work, teaching, that is aimed at my leisure and your leisure in this world, and most of all, hereafter. Vatican Council II has a beautiful little section I want to share with you on this score. In the Constitution on the Liturgy, number 2, it is giving a backdrop of what liturgy is in the church, and with four couplets indicating a backdrop of what the church is about, so we can understand what we're doing in liturgy, which, by the way, is another example of leisure. Liturgy has those traits we've considered about leisure. And I'd like to share 2 sentences here with you. The first one has the 4 couplets. Each one is incarnational and eschatological. And if you're not so sure what those words mean, sleep well tonight, don't worry about it. I don't want to take the time to explain that. But for those of you who do understand, it will be helpful. Here is the passage. It is of the essence of the church that she be both human and divine, visible and yet invisibly endowed, eager to act and yet devoted to contemplation, present in this world and yet not at home in it. I'd love to talk about that sentence for a while. It's immensely rich. But I must get to the next sentence because that's our main point here. The church is all these things, these 4 couplets, in such a way, notice, not in any kind of way, not as one brick happens to be placed on top of another. No, there's an intrinsic connection between the elements in these couplets. And the church is saying here in the council that the church is this in such a way that in her, the human, is directed and subordinated to the divine, the visible likewise to the invisible, action to contemplation, and this present world to that city yet to come which we seek. Now, I'm interested in those 3 words, action to contemplation. Action, our work, is subordinated and directed to our contemplation, which is a compact little philosophical way of saying what this particular point bears on. Namely, that our work exists for leisure and not the other way around. So that if we're working properly, cooking a meal, teaching a class, scrubbing a floor, administering, nursing, you name it, if we're working properly, we're working not only that someday we will have a vacation and tonight we can go home and rest and then we have a weekend perhaps. All of that is true and good. Most of all, though, we're working that we ourselves who are doing the work and those we're benefiting in the work may come to leisure in their life and thus be enriched, as we have been speaking in the whole series. The third consequence that follows, I've already mentioned, that is part of the consequence, and the rest of it is something new. Namely, I have already said last time that leisure is super useful. It is better than useful. Work is useful, and therefore we call it utilitarian. It's a means to an end, as we have said. But leisure is beyond usefulness. It is so good that it's even beyond being a means to an end, being useful. Now, what I didn't say thus far is that leisure is the measure of all usefulnesses. Because if all those things we have said, and especially the final leisure, that measures how useful particular works are. This is why, among works to be done, teaching is considered the most lofty of them all. I'm not talking now about sacraments and liturgy. That really is in the leisure category. I'm talking about whether it's digging a ditch or selling that insurance policy or teaching a class. Let's rest on the last one. The usefulness of sundry works is measured by how well they bring us to leisure, bring the worker and the people benefiting from the work. It's the measure of all usefulnesses. Therefore, teaching is so marvelous a work because it's introducing students to knowledge, truth, and I hope wonder. By the way, let me rapidly say this. Any teacher, whether it's just plain abstract mathematics or biology, anything in nature just awesome, as we already said, should be leading the students to wonder, to be amazed, and to be enriched by the subject. And I know, because I've talked to mathematicians, you'd think that must be dry as straw. It can be made most fascinating, because mathematics is all bound up with the nature of the physical universe. And therefore, teaching is so valuable a work because it leads people to be enriched with truth, to rest in truth, to be wonder-filled at it, and therefore at leisure. Thank you. We'll take up next time.